So we move to the second topic for today. I believe in the resurrection of the body. I'm going to take you through a story now, a history of biblical awareness and ways of looking at it. Let's look at this, I believe in the resurrection of the body, within Judaism first. And I'm confident in what I'm offering you now, so check it by all means. But first point, in the traditional Israel view, the dead are imagined to be lifeless shades down in a place they call Sheol. And there's plenty, the Greeks call it Hades. It's the same, it means, because you put people in a tomb down in the ground, and they imagined the world as being heavens and the earth, and there was a third plane under the earth, and that's where the dead are. But the dead are there, they're not alive, they're not ever going to be alive, but they exist. And the best way I can imagine is they're like shades, you know, and you've probably read about Aeneas and some of this stuff. You just, ghosts. Here's a text, Psalm 88, verse 3. My soul is full of troubles. My life draws near to Sheol. That's the place of death. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. The pit is the grave, physical grave. Sheol is the metaphysical, imagined place for the dead. I'm like those who have no help, like those forsaken among the dead, like the slain that lie in the grave, like those who you remember no more, for they are cut off from your hand. Psalm 115, verse 17. The dead do not praise Yahweh, nor do any that go down into silence. And they're kind of bargaining with God. Don't let me die, because while I'm alive, I can praise you. When I'm dead, it's all over. You're losing all my praise. So keep me alive for a bit longer. That's what's behind it. I'm trying to get you the mentality. These are typical, by the way. I'll give you many more. Isaiah 38. Sheol cannot thank you. The death cannot praise you. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. It's all over now. Once you die, that's all we've got, is life, now. Sirach, 200 BC, getting quite close to Christian times. Who will sing praises to the Most High in Hades? Now it's influenced by the Greek Hellenistic world, so the word they're using is Hades in the Greek. From the dead, as from one who doesn't exist, thanksgiving has ceased. And there wouldn't be anyone to disagree with that. That's the way they looked at it. Second point. There are phrases among these the ancient Israel people longing for an enduring relationship with God, longing for something beyond death, a longing. They didn't have any hope for it, but they longed for it. Here's Psalm 16, verse 9. My heart is glad, my soul rejoices, my body also rests secure, for you do not give me up to Sheol. That's a person dying but still alive. You do not let your faithful one see the pit. You show me the path of life. In your presence there's fullness of joy. In your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Very hopeful. Forevermore. You can feel a longing in it, and it's quite beautiful. Psalm 49, verse 15. God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. He will receive me. It didn't mean I'll rise from the dead. He'll rescue me from it by restoring me to health. Get it? Sheol is just getting its... The reaper is coming in about to... But I'll go into remission or something like that. Psalm 73, verse 23... I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me with honor. Whom have I in heaven but you? There's nothing on earth that I desire other than you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. A beautiful love statement that transcends death in the mind of the author. Three, third point. There's an emerging belief in the resurrection of the dead. Emerging belief, we can trace. A kind of hopeful signs and half intimations of eternity and whatever. If you read Ezekiel 37, for example, that's actually a battle image, and it's about the army all in the dead, like dry bones, and then they're praying that the Spirit of God will come and fill the bones and the sinews we put on, and the army will rise again. It's about the nation, really, coming out of the ashes. But in it, there's some kind of a... There's more than that. There's a beginnings of thinking, I wonder if it was possible if we could, you know. Here's an apocalyptic text, which means it's quite late. It belongs to the Greek period, 4th century BC or something. Here's Isaiah 26, verse 14 and 19. The dead do not live, shades do not rise, because you've punished and destroyed them and wiped out all memory of them. But your dead will live. Their corpses shall rise. O dwellers in the dust, awake, sing for joy, for your dew is a radiant dew, and the earth will give birth to those long dead. What was in the mind of the author, I can't tell you. Of course, with certainty. Was he meaning you'll rise up because your children will once again be free? You know, is it actually talking about the resurrection of the dead the way we would imagine it? Maybe, maybe not. I can't tell you, because you're using poetry and you're talking about metaphor here. There's a lot of depth to it, a lot of... So, however, that there's something going on there. That's, now when you come to the Syrian persecutions in 168 BC, you have a breakthrough of insight, which is the beginnings of what we're talking about here this morning. In the ancient Jewish world, the world of the Bible, let's put it that way, that's why people wanted to live a long life. And if you didn't live a long life and you died young, well, that was some punishment from God, because you'd sinned, or your parents had sinned, or someone had sinned, because God had cut you off in half life. If you lost a war, you're a military person, and you lost the battle and were slaughtered, well, they were always looking for why. Because God's kind of controlling the world, as they imagined it. And if God wanted us to win the battle, we'd win the battle. And when we celebrate, or they used to celebrate, I can't imagine it anymore, but, you know, the Battle of Lepanto, Our Lady Help of Christians, won that great naval battle for Europe against the Turks. Great, but the trouble is they'd lost about four battles before that, so what was Mary doing then? Do you know what I mean? It doesn't quite add up, if you're going to look at it, because she lost all those, but the ones she... So it was a way of looking at the world that's, I suppose, yeah, belonged to that time. So we're celebrating this great victory of Mary over the Turks. Oh, I don't know why I said all that. Anyhow, back to here. Syria, in 168 AD, something happened. That is, the Antiochus Epiphanes IV of Syria came down and persecuted the Jews in Jerusalem. And it was a heroic period of the martyrs. And you had young men, young women, old men and old women. You had a people who kept their faith. They were determined to hold on to their Jewish faith and not to submit to the Syrian stuff, which was all, by the way, to get enough money to pay the Romans off, because the Romans left them independent in Syria as long as they came up with this tribute that had to be poured. Well, that was the ancient world, and not only the ancient world, that's happened right up till now. So we're still doing it, I'm sure. So all the money had to go to Rome, and they didn't have enough, so they thought, well, here's the temple in Jerusalem, let's go and get all we can out of that. And so they were subjecting these people, and they were martyrs. So if you're living in a community where people die young because of their faith, you've got to start thinking differently. It could hardly be a punishment from God, could it? If your 18-year-old boy stood by his faith and became a martyr rather than give in and join the Syrians and that, they looked on it as heroic behaviour. So they had to start thinking differently. They couldn't see it as punishment from God, for heaven's sake. It's heroic. So they started to think there must be more to life than what we know. Death can't be the end. It can't be the finish of it. You must be able to praise God even when you're dead. So here we have the first statement in the Bible of explicit awareness. We're not saying everyone agreed with it, and you'll know from the New Testament stories, the Acts of the Apostles, that not everyone did agree with it. You will recall Paul having a great debate because the Pharisees agreed with the resurrection for the dead, but the Sadducees didn't. So there was a debate going on at the time of Jesus, and I think you know about it. And you know that silly story when they tried to make fun of Jesus about a woman who had a husband and he died, and then he had another, and then he had seven husbands. Well, who's going to be the husband in heaven? Ha, ha, ha. Trying to make fun of Jesus, and he knocks them over in one little sentence. You know, he says, you don't know what you're talking about, and you don't know the power of God, and he talks about God being the God of the living, not the dead, and so on. So, but Paul, too, believed in the resurrection of the dead. And then the Sadducees, because it wasn't part of their biblical tradition. It wasn't part of the tradition. And you had these newfangled Pharisees who started, by the way, at the time of the Syrian, that's where the beginnings of the Hasidim, who became the Pharisees later, they had their origins at this period, 168 BC through. So they believed in it. So you've got, still at the time of Jesus, uncertainty about it. But here we have the first statement from Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, and it's also in the second book of Maccabees. At that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book, God's book, recording angel book. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. You see the beginnings of the idea there in that text. Fourth point, still within Judaism now, ancient Judaism. They had these extraordinary stories of heroes being assumed. And they're legendary, they're imaginative. Enoch, right back in the book of Genesis. But you know that nothing in the book of Genesis is history, I hope. And very little of the books of the Pentateuch are history. I mean, there were real people and real events, but these aren't part of it. This is mythology here. This is a reconstruction of people's mind and thinking so that they can get to the heart of their religion. This is storytelling of the best kind, really. So, but in that ancient story, Enoch, quote, Genesis chapter 5, he walked with God and he was no more because God took him. That's all you know about Enoch in the whole of the Bible. But they loved that at this time. God took him. So what did God do? God took him, assumed into heaven with God, and oh, gee, this is extraordinary. What's going to happen? They don't know, but that's Enoch. So he becomes, so when they started at the time, the second century before Christ, the first century before Christ, the first and second century after Christ, all that period where you've got these volumes of material written on the side, you know, all kinds of stuff that keeps getting dug up, you know, Gospels according to this, and not Gospels, that's New Testament, but the testament of everyone in the, every one of the 12 patriarchs when they died had a testament that's there. You can find it in writing. Well, of course, they didn't say it, but it's literature. Very interested, and they're very interested in the world to come. Of course you would be. And the Greeks were too, and the Romans were, and so were the Jews. So all of them are about Enoch. There's about four books of Enoch written, all about describing heaven, judgment, eternity, what it's going to be like, and because people were fascinated by it, but they're just stories. Well, that's him. Elijah was another key character who was ascended in a whirlwind to heaven. And with Elijah, because now you're getting close, it's not history yet, but it's legend from historical data. So he's the 9th century BC, 10th century BC. So, or 9th, I can't remember now. 9th or 10th century BC. And they expected Elijah to come back. And even at the time of Jesus, remember in the Gospel, is John the Baptist, is that really Elijah come back? They had this idea. And then Herod, when he chopped the head off, and he thought Jesus was John the Baptist come back. So in the magical, mythical mentality of the New Testament period, it was very easy for people to get the idea that someone was someone come back, particularly Elijah. Who do people say I am, Jesus? And some say you're Elijah. Some say you're Jeremiah or one of the prophets. Come back, like being taken up into heaven, but of course you're not dead yet. So he said, come back, and come back as Jesus. Or we can't get into that. Well, you can get into it if you want to, but it's a mentality quite different from ours. And that you've got to do that to go back to these ancient texts. And here's the Book of Wisdom, written at the time, just the the turn of the age, just at the beginning of the 20 BC or 20 AD or that kind of period. Book of Wisdom, chapter 4, there were some who pleased God and were loved by him, and while living among sinners were taken up, assumed. That's the mentality. And by the way, going back to our earlier question, we're still in the same mentality. We talk about Mary's assumption. We're still in the same world, the same imaginative world, dramatically mythical world.